Welcome to the Sweetland podcast series, Topics in Writing. Each episode, we feature interviews with guests at the Sweetland Seminar about topics in the teaching of writing.
I'm Tia Hetzel, and today I'll be speaking with Judy Swan of Princeton University about writing and science. When Judy Swan was growing up, everyone told her she'd have to pick just one thing to do, but that's not been true. After starting out in scientific research, she now teaches writing to scientists at all levels in education, industry, and government. A graduate of Harvard University and MIT, Judy is currently an associate director of the Princeton Writing Program, where she gets to work with 18 different academic disciplines as she ponders why we all have so much trouble communicating with one another. Judy, thank you and welcome.
All right. Thank you, T. I'm really glad to be here again.
Judy, let's talk about what does writing and science mean? What do we mean when we say writing and science?
So there's sort of two answers to that. One is to imagine it's the classic, are there lumpers or dividers? There are people who divide the world into two categories and those who say that doesn't work. So I tend to think that in some level, writing is writing, and we'll talk a bit about that. What unites the writing that I focus on and the people I work mostly with at Princeton is people who write about data. So people who are tasked with making knowledge and telling stories and creating accounts where the focus is something that's quantitative, something that's out there, something where there's a real cycle of reliability and reproducibility that's involved in, and how do you write about that? How do you talk about that? So it's what unites, when some of the departments are sociology that does this kind of work, economics, engineering, science, they are trying to make arguments where much of the evidence is quantitative or sometimes visual, or particularly these days, the visualization of quantitative information.
And sometimes writing in science has sort of a bad rap in some ways.
Right.
And you're, I think, someone who is telling the other story of that.
So it's more that I think it has to do with the way writing for a long time was in the provenance of English departments and tied to literature. And so I know that when I was in going to college and even before that, that writing seemed to be something that was subjective and was in the humanities, and that the objects of writing that we studied were poems and short stories and things where the conversation is about character and etc. So you get this whole thing of like, oh, the humanities, they're focused on people, they're focused on stories of people, they're all about emotion. And then you run into these situations in the sciences where none of that seems to carry over.
Right. So how does it work in science, or does it carry over?
Well, so I think it does carry over. So it carries over. A lot of what I think I'm doing these days is I think that what everyone in science, everyone who's writing needs is a way, at least doing academic writing, where the goal is to try to create and present some piece of knowledge that is both localized in that I know this, but we're hoping to make it not just local. I know this, but I can write about it and present it to you, and if this works, now you know it too. And so, and now this becomes eventually, if a lot of us know it, it's knowledge and it's something that we believe. And so everybody who's doing that has to engage ultimately with textual analysis, because that work is carried out at a textual level. And I define a text often the way people do in cultural studies, a text broadly, that a text is a mark on a screen or a page that's meant to communicate information. So my definition of text includes visual representations and figures and tables and anything that is meant to give something to a reader and communicate something with. So
and the reader is so vital when you're conceiving, even as the writer.
Well, the whole purpose here, the emergence here is a transaction between a writer who thinks they see something, but what they see, personal, it's this notion that personal knowledge is not knowledge until it's shared, that what we, in Michael Pagliani's work, that tacit knowledge is important, but it's got to get explicit and shared by other people. And so there's epistemology, the making of knowledge through inquiry seems to have as this necessary step that it's not really known until more than one person can know it. And so academic arguments are always trying to create a text that allows somebody else to know something that they didn't know before the text because they've now followed some sort of process of learning it. So that's textual analysis. And the home in the academy of textual analysis is in literary studies. Now, the objects in literary studies are poems and literature, but the practices of how do you engage with texts, those practices actually carry across the community. So one here's a good analogy or a good example. I like to say that I'll talk about Princeton. So Princeton gets these great undergraduates, and many of them are really good at reading. And some of the ones that are not only good readers but really like to read decide they're going to go into literary studies because that's what they want to spend their time doing. So it was a revelation to me when I finally was part of a broad faculty of colleagues from many different disciplines, and I started not assuming that I knew what other disciplines did, but actually listening and learning and starting to, gee, they do that. So what is the methodology of literary studies? Which is already an odd word because people in literary studies don't think of methodology as one of their questions. But
it's there.
But it's there. And as soon as you go out, as soon as you start looking at other disciplines, every other discipline has to forefront a question of methodology. And that allows you to say, well, why doesn't literary studies do that? Because they have a method question that is pretty much resolved. They use a similar method. So one of the core methods in literary studies is, quote, close reading. And this is really interesting. So that students who show up at the university and they read well and they want to do more, get trained, explicitly trained for probably a full year in close reading. And I thought this was fascinating because here you took students who were already sophisticated readers and liked to do it, and they had to learn to read differently and read better. And nobody has I won't say that. I'm having trouble finding a really clear statement of close reading, even though it seems to be this very tightly kept sense of this is what it means to do literary studies. But it seems to be a way of reading that does not take for granted the appearance of any element of a text and knows how to ask questions about why does it look this way and not some other way. Really useful, clearly, for poetry, and this is where most of us encounter some notion of close reading in poetry. But this idea of asking about a text, why does it look this way? What is it suppressing, or what are alternative ways that it might look? Scientists do that all the time.
But not necessarily with the text itself.
No, they do it with the text.
Oh, they do.
And
okay.
So they do it with the text as well. And it wasn't until I was talking to, trying to figure out what is it that I want graduate students to learn about text that their advisors know and that they don't name, but they assume that students should know. And so I've sat with professors walking their way through a text. There's actually a published article that does this by Devita Charney in Jack Seltzer's book, Understanding Scientific Writing. Understanding Scientific Prose. So she took the article that whole book is centered around. It's an article by Stephen Gould and Richard Lewontin on evolutionary biology. And she took the article and gave it to readers of different degrees of experience in evolutionary biology and said, I'm turning on a tape recorder. Talk me through your reading of this article. And one of her findings is this one that practicing scientists are sort of startled by, and then they realize, well, of course, but that's what I do. What she found is that the more experienced the scholar, the reader, the less likely they were to read linearly, and that they would immediately go to the figures. They would take an overview of the whole thing, and they would start to hone in and dive in on particular elements of it. Charles Bazeman found this as well with physics writers, that physicists seemed, as he described, to have a schema for how do they understand the world, and they read papers strategically to see what if the information in this paper changed, how does it fit with my schema, how does it change my schema. So that turns out to be a form of close reading, typically, because it's looking closely at, gee, there are these data. Do I believe them? Why do they look like this? And I've heard professors talk their way through a paper or talk it as a teaching tool for students.
And so can professors, can instructors bring this
absolutely
way of reading here's one. Transparently into the classroom?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one, so a lot of what I'm thinking about now, what I'm going to talk about with Sweetland today, is the ways that what we think we know and what we believe other people know that are actually getting in the way of doing the real work. So that we carry beliefs about who our students are or how our literature is put together or what we do, and we make assumptions about what people can and cannot do. So this is a classic expert novice belief system, that experts know how to do things that they sometimes can't name how they know. And that the process of developing expertise is developing a lot of tacit understanding that we always can't always name. There's a lovely paper that we also are reading in Sweetland today out of the University of California at Irvine on students talking about where they learned writing. And what the papers T has the title, which I don't remember, but I didn't want to misquote. Pedagogical Memory, Writing, Mapping, and Translating by Susan Jarrett, Kathleen Mack, Alexandra Sartor, and Siobhan Watson. And I remember hearing this paper as a paper at the Four C's. And I actually know little bits that are not so much in this paper. But they talked about this experience of talking to students in their disciplinary writing courses about where they learn to do those things. And what's glossed lightly but was at the talk and it was so wonderful is that when they surveyed them and said, how much did you learn this in freshman writing? Many of the students said, oh, I didn't learn anything in freshman writing, and it was completely useless. And they said it was the moment where you think, okay, we should all jump off a cliff.
Right.
But what they talked about at the conference and is brought out in this paper is that since all of these students were not committed to interviews, the interviews was the opportunity to watch them develop a pedagogic memory, which I love the way they framed it here. That wasn't in place when I heard the talk. They could watch them in real time start to talk through what is the tacit knowledge they're bringing to their disciplinary writing, and in conversation with an interlocutor discover that, in fact, it hadn't just always been there or emerged full-blown. They had had to develop it, and some of that development, in fact, had begun in first-year writing and was framed by it.
And how can we further that, then, Judy?
Oh, if I had an answer to that, I don't have a... So that seems to be...
But that's hopeful. Thank goodness.
That is the question. So here's where expert practitioners can question their own expertise and not take the taken for granted answer of, oh, we just know this, or this is obvious, or this is a logical way of reading. To recognize that the kind of reading that an expert practitioner in the sciences or in economics or anywhere else brings to the reading of a published paper is a set of practiced skills that can be modeled for students and have to be modeled. So I'll give you a version in economics. So economics is out of field for me, but I teach workshops to juniors developing a research project in economics on writing a prospectus, and I'll do it paired often with an economics insider. So I'm trying to think about how does this look as language practices. And they're talking about what does it feel like in economics, and they'll give the vocabulary to anchor this and to make that connection between what I'm saying in a slightly abstract way, because it's about the genre of a proposal. And they're saying in an economics terminology of what is the work we're doing in economics here. So there is the opening table in any economics research paper is described by an economist as the table of means and what they mean. And it's a performative table that economists all look for it because it is essentially the representation of the data that will be analyzed in this paper. And it's the representation of the data in the form of the means, various means that can be calculated from these values, and how and what do those means mean, i.e., are they sensible means? One of the things that students will do, novices to working with data, is they will get a mean that is a silly mean, and we actually use a figure, and somebody has the mean values for the number of trades on the New York Stock Exchange between per day between 2000 and 2009, and there's an average value there, but you also want to see the minimum and the maximum, and the minimum was zero. And that tells you there's something funny about the data, because there is a value in that data that says there was a day that the stock market was open and no trades were made. And that sounds like a mistake. And so it's a way, you know, the appearance of, so this is called a closed reading. Why is there a zero in this data set? What does that zero mean? And we ask students to, well, think about, what does this mean? And somebody says, are they including weekends? I said, that's an excellent question. So you can open the data set and say, and you have to say, no, we're not including weekends. So now there's a real zero point. Why is there a zero point? And why is, you know, what is it telling us? And eventually we come around, can you imagine a day that the stock market was open between 2000 and 2009, where there was a zero day and no trades were made? And finally somebody says September 11th, and it's not September 11th, the market closed. September 12th.
Oh, yes.
The market reopened on September 12th, but no trades were made. And so this tells you that it's a real data set, but it also means that you got to take that day out to ask the data question. And so here's an example of a close reading, and it's not even in my field. So this is, economists know how to look at a table like that and ask questions of it. And they had to learn to do that. And asking students to perform that as juniors is also asking them to engage with the reading and being able to read a table and say, oh, this writer hasn't really looked at this data, because if they had, they would explain why there's a zero and then explain why they are allowed to take that day out.
And can you apply it then to, or how does it apply to writing in science? Then,
it applies to anything. So this is
the close reading.
Close reading. So to close up that circle of, here we have our readers who are gifted readers, and in the humanities, they're trained in close reading. But here's the gap. Scientists are doing close reading, but they don't even have the vocabulary. Never mind the set, once the vocabulary is in place, it's like, okay, we are doing something called a close reading. Where do we learn to do that? What are the practices that do it? When is it happening? And if the answer is at the level of instruction of, I don't know, then, but you're expecting your students to learn it, then here's an opportunity to, again, reflect on your own practice. And this is the opening up of where, if we're assuming that I know this and everybody knows it and I was never taught, which is very much what you get when you ask people in the sciences, where did you learn to write? And they all say, well, I just learned it, and or I always knew. Well, that's clearly crazy. So you must have learned it somewhere, and we must be teaching it somewhere. And so to open up the question and say, where is it happening? What is it that we're doing? There's a kind of self-reflection on your own practice. And, you know, maybe this is, I know we're coming to the close of our time, to wrap this as, I'm connected tangentially to Danny Kahneman's book on Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, which I have not read the book. I've heard Kahneman talk and heard excerpts from it, so I need to actually do my homework and read the book carefully. But he talks about what he calls the fast thinking, which is the mode that allows us to operate and get things out of the way, and then these slow analytic processes. And what he's studying is that the fast thinking, while it mostly gets through, it's wrong in a lot of things. Our ability to estimate is incomplete, and that we need to slow down and look more deeply. And I think a lot of conversations about writing in science, we define writing with the fast system. Writing is grammar, which is what the students here do, even though it clearly isn't. Or, I didn't learn anything in my composition course because it was about X. And it takes the slowing down and unpacking it and not assuming that we know what it is to see what it is we're actually doing.
Well, is that what then students can do?
And everyone can do it. I mean,
right.
Faculty can model it.
Yes.
Assignments can ask students to do it. But part of it is to sort of grab and make clear. What generates the motive for that is getting the fast thinking out there in a way that you say, okay, yeah, I know you know this, but now let's go do something, so that the knowing and the doing can be next to each other, and you can see that the doing and the knowing are not the same. They're not talking to the same thing, that what we're doing is about a kind of knowing that isn't captured by that quick answer of knowing. And the economist says this is how you get off system one, when system one is confronted with the fact that it's not or the main mind is presented with the fact that the system one answer isn't working. And now I have to go analyze this and think more deeply, and it becomes much richer. And I think that's part of what's happening in science, is so often writing gets treated as if we should be able to do it like riding a bicycle, like it's system one, when in fact to write in science is to do science, and that's not a system one process, that's system two. That's deep analysis, and it's much slower.
Judy, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has been wonderful.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Sweetland podcast series, Topics in Writing, recorded at the University of Michigan. For more information about the Sweetland Center for Writing, visit us on the web at lsa.umich.edu/sweetland.